tradition three. Trying to keep it on time, you know. Two or more persons, when gathered together for mutual benefit, may call themselves a relationship. The only basic requirements for a good marriage or relationship are a mutual desire to be in the relationship and willingness to make it work. One person alone cannot make a relationship work. How many times have you tried to make something work that just didn't gonna work? No matter what you do, you've got to both be willing to be there. You've got to both be willing to work on the relationship. I sit there and laughed hysterically when Donald Trump got on TV and he said, if you have to work on a relationship, there's something wrong with it. I thought, that explains your problems, Donald. Now I'm telling you, you've got to work on something for it to be, you know, that's just like if you own a home. If you just go sit and live in that home and don't ever do any maintenance to that home will fall down around your ears. And the same thing's true with a relationship. You've got to put something in it, you know. J.D. and I will be married 32 years this year. We have had to put a lot in. You know, we had a lot to overcome. You know, it's easier to start a new relationship than it is to work on a broken one. The broken one is much harder because you got a lot of history there to have to deal with, you know, and things in old tapes and stuff to have to get rid of, you know. But I find it works. But now willingness, you've got to be willing to grow, and you've got to allow that person to grow at their own pace. And some are going to grow faster than others. Some will be slower, you know. But the willingness without action is just a fantasy on your part. You know, you say, I'm willing to do this and I'm willing to do that. But if you're not taking the action, that willingness is just a little story you've got ripping around in your head. It's not doing anything, you know. It's like if I'm going to go to Alaska, I got to get my butt up here on a boat or somehow to get up here. I can just sit in my living room all day long thinking about going to Alaska and it ain't getting me there. You know, I got to take an action. And sometimes I find that in our relationship, we sort of swap back and forth with our degree of willingness. Some days I'm more willing. Some days I'm just not willing, you know. Some days I am just so into self that it's all about me and I'm not willing to work on a relationship that day. I don't have that as a conscious thought, but if you look at my actions, you'll see it. There it is, you know. She's not willing to work on the relationship this day. And sometimes it's like you get up and you know you're not in a good spot. You just know you're not doing pretty well today. You don't feel spiritually connected. That's one of your first things you'll notice. And you feel out of sorts, and everything is annoying to you. You know, it's like sort of being in an exaggerated PMS. The girls know, and the guys should if you've lived with one. You know, sensitive bitch, I think, is the term that you would use. Okay? And when we're in one of those kind of things, you know, I usually say, hey, you know, I'm not in a good place today. You know, I'm not in a really good place. So just remember, you know, today, don't put a lot of stuff on me today because I'm just not able to deal with it very well today. You know? And that's communicating where I'm at. That's telling somebody, hey, I'm not. So don't expect a hell of a lot from me today. But remember, all things come to pass. And if you don't have a bunch of stuff put on you, that deal will pass. But the more it's put on you when you're in one of those can't handle it things, the more irritable, restless, and discontent you'll become. Now, I've stayed in a relationship for many reasons other than I wanted to be there. And I bet you have too. Felt trapped maybe, a little trapped in a relationship. Had fear of emotional or financial security. Confusion, not knowing what to do. There's a lot of people that go into a relationship don't have a clue what they, you know, I'm here, I don't know why I'm here, but I'm here. And then there's the materialism. I've got somebody that's got a lot of money, and I can have all the things I want, and I like my things. I like my things. And then there's pity, not love. Feeling sorry for that person, you know. He needs me. He needs me. And pride. Not willing to admit you've made a mistake. This is not the deal, you know. And the funny thing about it is, I remember when J.D. and I first got married, or when we first met even, the new relationship, isn't it wonderful? Somebody says, what's he like? Oh, God, you know, he's so handsome. He's so sweet. He's so wonderful. He's just perfect. Okay? And you're looking at his potential. Because see, somewhere lurking, you know that, you know, I mean, he does this, it's annoying, but I can work on that. And what have you, you know. But after your marriage or commitment, you know, the first thing you're good about is changing them. Changing them. You get the piece of paper, it says, you may change him now, you know. I mean, that's somehow or another, you know, it's real funny. But when you're living together or when you're dating or whatever, it's a little different than when you sign the paper on the dotted line. It's like you own one another or something at that point. I don't know what happened. You know, it just, J.D. said, I sold him a bad bill of goods. He said, you were nice and sweet and you went along with everything. And I said, yes, but that's before. Now we've got to be responsible because, you know, we've got married. We got to handle things here now. You've got to stop that drinking. You've got to stop this and that. And, you know, these bad habits, you know, I mean, we're married now. And he goes, oh, you know, I mean, it's like somehow, and you know, and I didn't realize that I was trying to change him, make him do all the adjustments. It just appeared to me in my self-centeredness that he was the only one that needed changing. I mean, after all, I mean, you can see I was a prize, you know. My mother said to me when I got married, she says, now it's your bed, you lie in it. You know? And so I wouldn't admit I made a mistake for nothing after that. That's the reason I lived in that first marriage for 8 years. I knew it was over after the honeymoon. But I stayed in there for 8 years because I didn't want to give her the satisfaction of being right. You know, that's miserable. And you know, sometimes it's just easier to stay with the known than it is to jump into the unknown. Sometimes you'll stay. Just for that, because it's easier, you know what you gotta do. But when the knowing of the unknown, when that, you know, when the fear of the unknown is not as great as the fear of what you know you gotta put up with, then you'll make a change. You'll take a chance and do something different. I had things that kill relationships, fear, dishonesty, especially about your feelings. When you're dishonest with each other about your feelings and you have these hurt feelings or these anger feelings or whatever, and they'll say, what's wrong? You'll say, nothing. Nothing. It's being dishonest instead of saying how you feel. Obsessions ruin relationships. You know, those obsessions, those things, you know, that need, you know, my thing, I had that need for attention, that first relationship. I needed attention so desperately I found it in nightclubs. My husband played in a band. And while he would play the band, I would play the room. I had that thing for excitement and for attention. Mental unfaithfulness will ruin a relationship. It makes you very unhappy with what you have at home. Because in your mental deal, your fantasy about someone else, they are going to be perfect. They're going to do things the way you want them to do. They're going to be the way you want them to be. They're going to look the way you want them to look. And then you'll start comparing the person you're living with to the fantasy person. And the more you do that, the more discontent you become with what you have at home. Been there, done that one. Avoidance. Being unavailable. Blocking them out. Being unavailable physically and emotionally. Just being unavailable. And then the control. You know, I always loved the attitude in the bedroom. It was the dog yummy theory. You're good, you get some. You're bad, you don't get some. You know, sex was a dog yummy. You know, give them a milk bone. What the heck, you know. It wasn't a part of the relationship. It wasn't an intimacy thing. It was just sex. Then there was abuse. Physical, verbal, and punishments. You know, the punishments, how we got even with one another. You know, the little sick, sadistic things that we do to get even with one another when we would get angry, not knowing how to do that. My first husband, I told him, I said, if you ever hit me, that's it. That's it. I will not put up with that. And then he did. And did I leave? No, I didn't. Why didn't I leave? Well, I could have given you all the reasons I used at the time. I was in a foreign country, but the bottom line was I didn't want to go back home and tell the old girl she's right. And then there was, you know, why did he hit you? I don't think there's a reason to hit people. I've done it, but I don't think, you know, when I look at it through a little more sanity now. But at the time, I called him a name that he took very, very offensive. Wasn't a big deal. I had heard the words. I had just never said them before. Some bitch didn't seem like a bad deal to me. You know, but he took it really personally, like I talked about his mother. I didn't even dream that's what it was about, you know. I mean, I'm a young woman. How did I know? We were in the military. You heard lots of words you didn't know what were. And he said, don't you call me that. Well, don't tell me what I can do. I said, some bitch. And he said, I'm warning you, don't you say that to me again. Some bitch, son of a bitch. And boy, I mean, he just hauled off and he knocked me flat in the floor. And I'm laying down there. I looked up at him. I said, some bitch. See, I'm the kind you'd have to kill. You know. And so I said, you know, it takes a big man to hit a woman, don't it? And I said, but you got to sleep sometime. And when you do, you may wake up with an ice pick in your head. And so he moved out to the plot line. And the thing of it was, that was not an idle threat. Because I was mad. And I wouldn't shed a tear. He didn't realize my mother physically abused me as a child. She abused me many, many times. And the way you got her was you didn't cry. So see, I was not, but you got even. You got even. Do things to get even. I had the disease of Moore, you know. I love, my favorite explanation of disease of Moore is the drunk who walks into the bar and he sees a sign, oh, you can drink for a dollar. And he says, I want $2 worth. You know, I mean, but that's the way I live my life. You know, that's how I lived, you know. And I lived in a world of fantasy and denial. You know, that's like the priest and the rabbi. They all, and an Al-Anon, they all died and went to hell. And they're down there and discussing the situation. And the rabbi and the priest were talking about it, and the priest says, what did you do to get to be sent to hell? He said, it was pork. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, the next door neighbors fixed pork chops one night, invited me over. I ate pork, got the taste of pork, and you know, I'm Jewish, we're not supposed to eat pork. So that's what happened. I know that's why I'm here. And he said, why are you here? And the priest said, well, it was sort of the same thing. It was next door neighbor's daughter. You know. And so he said, I just never could get a hold on that celibacy thing, you know. And he said to the Al-Anon, he said, why are you here? And she said, what do you mean? He said, what did you do to get sent to hell? And she said, well, it's not hot and I'm not here. That's the way we are, you know. This can't be happening, you know. This kind of thing can't be happening, you know. And I had spiritual bankruptcy. That'll ruin a relationship. Another thing that really ruins relationships is bitching. That nagging, that incessant nee-nee-nee-nee-nee-nee. This is one of the things I hated the worst in living at home with my mama. My mama never had a positive thing to say. It was just nee-nee-nee-nee-nee. And then one day you look in the mirror and guess what? You become your mama. Nee-nee-nee-nee-nee-nee. You know, it's like you pick out every bad thing in the world. You can't find anything good that's going on. I remember saying to my mama one time, I said, Mama, could you tell me something good that's happening in your life? Not a darn thing. I said, thank you. You know, but it's there's another little story I love, and it's about this little woman that entered the convent to become a nun. And they had to take a vow of silence. And so for 10 years, she wasn't allowed to say a word. And then the Mother Superior calls her in, and she said, you've been a very good, faithful nun, praying, doing everything you should. We're going to allow you to say two words. And she said, bed's hard. And she said, that's right, the beds are hard here. Go and pray. So 10 years later, they bring her back. So you're allowed two more words. And she said, food stinks. And they said, that's right, go back and pray. And so they call her back at the next 10 years. She said, I quit. And the Mother Superior says, well, thank God you haven't done anything but bitch since you've been here. Story of my life. Selfishness. It's what I want. It's about me. It's more. Mine, mine, mine. Like the little kid, you know. And the self-centeredness says it's all about me. And the self-seeking is what's in it for me. Those are things that destroyed my relationships. But the things that helped to heal those relationships were learning to have a sense of humor. You know, developing a sense of humor. Now, for those of you who might have known me when I was a kid growing up, I was sort of the class clown because that was the persona that I used to let you know that I was okay, and that was how I tried to get people to like me. But a lot of times the person who's laughing the most is hurt the most on the inside, and they're crying the most. And what that is the cry for attention. Look at me, love me, look at me, love me. That's not a sense of humor. That's a desperate need. That's a desperate need. But there's a difference, you know, in having a sense of humor. And so when I got in the program, I asked God every morning, you know, please help me. Help me not to be so intense about things today. Help me to have a sense of humor. And then that no matter what happens this day, God, help me to deal with it in a manner in which that, you know, it doesn't leave a lasting scar if I can. Well, one of the first things that happened that first year or so in sobriety, J.D. and I went out to his mother's. It was around Christmas time. And his mother had this really, really long driveway. And it wasn't paved. It was just a little gravel down the yard thing. And if you got off of the gravel, then you would sink up in the yard because it had just rained. And so J.D. said he was tired that night. And, of course, funny. So we drive in, and he said, I want you to drive. I said, all right. So I drove, and we were in pickup. And when we got there, they weren't home. And so he said, okay, now, I'm a really good driver forward. I am a lousy backup. I really am, you know. I would love to be, I envy people that can go in 60 miles an hour, you know, go four blocks. I would give anything to be, I'm in the movies, I'm just, oh, God, would that be wonderful? But I'm doing it like this. And so I did my little like that, and I was off and sunk to the axle. Sunk to the axle. And J.D. jumped out of the truck, and he ran around, and he looked at, I mean, it doesn't take a mental giant to feel the truck go down. I mean, you know you're there, you know. But the observation team was out, and he ran around there, and then he began to and he called me everything but a human being. And I had made a decision that morning that nothing was going to happen, was going to ruin my day. And I went back around, and I got out, and I looked at it, and I said, well, that didn't work. Now, would you like to call a wrecker? And he looked, and he started laughing. He said, I guess that didn't work. Now, see, before, I would have been the martyr. How could you say that to me? I would have cussed him back, you know, done the whole thing. And it was only by the grace of God, that's what I believe, that day, that God showed me that you can deal with it a different way. I didn't have to take it. You know, I mean, I knew I couldn't back up. He knew I couldn't back up, you know. But I did the best I could, and the best I could got me off. But that was one of my greatest gifts that year at Christmas, was not to have a rotten attitude, because I hated the holidays. It seemed to me every holiday, J.D. was in jail or something was going bad, and, you know, you had to use your whole Christmas bonus to take care of fines and stuff like that. So I did not look forward to Christmas time at all. But that year, I had a good Christmas, and life kept happening, but I had a good Christmas, you know. Another thing that I found is like my sister. Now, I don't know how many of y'all know, but November the 30th of 1999, my sister had renal failure, and her whole body shut down, and she died in the car with me. And I rushed her to a hospital, and they were able to revive her, but she has massive brain damage. She has anoxic brain injury, very little memory at all. And what she has is really confused. But I've had to develop a sense of humor in dealing with her. And she has to have 24-hour care. We have lots of problems with Dorothy. And it's like being in Mother Hell Part 2. Her personality has changed. She's more like my mother, which is not a good thing. You know, we always promised each other if we saw us getting like Mother, we'd kill one another. And, you know, it's like the people I love just don't stay dead. You know, it's like, I drowned J.D., he's back. Dorothy died, she's back. You know, it's like, what's wrong with my family that they can't die and stay dead? And Dorothy said to me, she says, would you promise me if I die in the car with you again that you'll let me stay dead? And I said, Dorothy, if you die in the car with me again, I will drive around for a minimum of 6 to 8 hours till you are stiff as a damn poker. She said, good. I said, yes. Take her with me to the grocery store, and she's like a five-year-old. She sees all these things that she wants, and she'll put them all in the cart. And when we get to the checkout, I just don't check them out. And she'll jump up and she'll say, you're so mean to me. You're so mean. And I'll say, that's right. That's the reason Mother calls me Meanie Pearl. I am. And I try to go to the same checker every time. You know, because they do look at you a little strange. But, you know, that's another thing. I have had to deal with that with a sense of humor because people do have a tendency to look at people who are handicapped or retarded or whatever. And that's sad. You know, you won't know, and if you haven't had to do the deal, you just don't know. You have to learn to make sincere amends, you know. In other words, you're going to have to be wrong sometimes, you know. And by making sincere amends, that helps heal damaged relationships. The first time that I made an amends to J.D. was because I thought he had stolen my cigarettes, and so I had screamed all over him. And you know how it would be if you were drinking and somebody, when you got up the next morning, somebody drank your booze overnight. Well, J.D. decided that he had quit drinking, he had quit smoking, and he just quit buying. And so I got up and I didn't have my cigarettes, and it just irritated me no end, so I accused him of stealing them, and I cussed him out. We had a big fight, and he left and went to my mother's. And he loved the enemy. You know, they'd go over there and gang up against me, you know. Mama loved him. She didn't care for me, but she loved J.D., because J.D. would agree with everything she said, and I fought her about everything. That's the reason we couldn't get along. We were too much alike. But anyway, one of the Al-Nun girls called, and she said, what are you doing? I told her about my litany here, about my cigarettes were gone. She said, do you not have any more money? And I said, well, yes, I got money. She said, how far away is the store? I said, well, neighborhood grocery, 2 or 3 blocks away. She said, why don't you go get you some cigarettes? Well, that's too simple. You see, he stole my cigarette, so he should have to be the one. She said, he's not doing without the cigarette. And she says, and besides that, you owe him an amends. And I said, what? She said, you owe him amends. I said, he stole my damn cigarettes and I owe an amends here? She said, yes, you owe the amends because you're the one who cussed him out and threw the fit. How important was it? Was it worth that? You know, how many times do we throw fits over such little stuff? When you think about that, may be the one thing that is really going to start that tear in your relationship that's going to get bigger and bigger. Because, you know, it's not usually big things. It's the fleas and ticks of life that drive you crazy. You can handle a big crisis, but it's that everyday nee-nee-nee-nee-nee-nee-nee that destroys more happiness and the closeness between people. And so I went over, and J.D. was out in my mother's backfield mowing the grass. He squared off when he saw me coming. And I went over there, and I said to him, you know, what's wrong? And he said, what? And I said, I was wrong. He said, what? I said, I was wrong. He goes, oh, my God. And then all of a sudden, tears began to form in his eyes. And I said, what? He said, do you realize you have never admitted you were wrong before? I said, that is a lie from the pit of hell. And you know how your mind will go? Like you're searching, 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 searching. And he goes, not found. Because I'm going to tell him, don't you remember when? And I realized I had never admitted I was wrong. That when we had an argument, he always had to apologize, or I would have carried it to the end of the time because I couldn't be wrong. I felt so low. I couldn't be wrong. My self-esteem would not let me be wrong. And I just felt so bad about that. And I said, well, I was wrong, and I'm sorry, and I won't fuss at you again about it. And, you know, that started a healing in our relationship when I could be wrong. And it's no big deal. I can be wrong all the time now. In fact, it's sort of nice. You know, you don't have to be so darn responsible, you know. And then you have to use forgiveness, you know. Put the past in the past. It's called a living amend, you know. Leaving the past. Don't keep saying, yeah, this is just like, you know. Because, see, I did that to him one afternoon. I said, you know, this is just like when such and such and such and such. And he looked at me and he said, wrong husband. Forgot, you know, forgot. And I have to be willing to keep on working and doing, not being lazy. You know, sometimes we're just lazy about holding up our part of the relationship, you know. And the more I work on my spiritual condition with God, the more my relationship with other people gets in line. Because when I'm in good condition with God, what you do doesn't really bother me so much. But when I'm not in good condition, if my spiritual condition is off, anything, you even look funny, you know. What did she mean by that? Did you see that eyebrow went up? Wonder what she was talking about. My clothes. I know she was. Look at her. Is there something wrong with my makeup? You know, you just get totally paranoid, you know. You know, you're not much, but you're all you think about. You know, that kind of thing. Tradition 4. Each partner should be autonomous, except in matters affecting the other partner, the family or relationship, or society as a whole. Now, autonomy means I have the freedom to do whatever I want to, but with that freedom comes the responsibility for any action I take. Now, will what I'm going to do make my partner angry? I don't know. Depends on where he's at, you know? That's not got to bother. You know, there's certain things that I know. You know the buttons that your people have, the buttons that you can push. You know those things. Stay away from those. But when I think about taking an action of some kind, and I'll say, well, let me run this past somebody else. Run it past my sponsor, somebody else that knows me. You know, get a little input out of the between your ears type, you know. Anything up here, you will co-sign. Anything here is always a good idea. You ever notice that? Sometimes when you hear yourself say it out loud, you know then it's not a good idea. But it sounded so good up here. What happened there, you know? My sponsor says your thinking's broken, so don't use it so much, you know. And that's true. I need to run it. And the most dangerous thing you can ever hear an Al-Anon or an AA to me say is, I've been thinking. I've been thinking, you know. And that's, oh, that's dangerous, you know. Because I don't know about your head, but I have committees that meet in my head. And we discuss stuff. And we co-sign stuff, you know. You know, that's just like the summer of the dry drunk. Here I was, you know. J.D., you know, he had quit drinking. He wasn't in AA. I was still crazy as a march hare, too. No treatment for any disease going on at our house. And I was miserable, absolutely miserable. And it was all his fault, always all his fault. And that's when it occurred to me. You see, I had thought for years and years, if he had quit drinking, I'd be okay. Well, guess what? He's not drinking. I'm not okay. Now, what's going on? Well, it's him. It wasn't the drinking. It's just him. You know, he needs to go. You know, well, why don't we just divorce him? Well, you can't divorce him. What do you mean you can't divorce him? Well, you know, you've already divorced one. If you have to divorce another one, then there might, you know, where's the common thread here, you know? Don't want to go there, you know. Well, I don't want to be a divorcee again either. That wasn't a great fun thing. But now, if he were to die, you could be a widow. Now, widow sounds good. It's honorable at least, you know. It's not like being divorced. It's not like being a loser, you know. You can be a widow, a little merry widow. But he's not dying. That's no big deal. We can handle that. Well, what do you mean? Well, just think about it. It's justifiable homicide no matter how you look at it. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's it, you know. I mean, it's just, there it is, you know. Well, what do you want to do? Well, I want to take an ice pick, stab him in the neck, and watch him drip. Oh, God, is that wonderful or what? You almost have an orgasm thinking about that. But, wait a minute. Let's back over him with the car. Squish him up in the tires. Make a note, buy new tires. You know, this is how the thinking's going. It sounds good. Makes sense to me. Why? Because it's all going on up here. I didn't have anybody to talk to. I didn't have anybody to tell anything to. And it sounded, it gave me light at the end of the tunnel. There was a way out of the hell that I was in. And so I grasped on to that, not having anything else. And so as the time went on, I saw in the paper where a lady had killed her husband and they had put her away anyway. And I'm thinking, I should have been on that jury. Nobody would have got her put away. If I'd have been there, I would have been the holdout. She would have walked, you know, because that was tacky. Tacky for them to convict a woman who lived when drunk. I mean, my God. But that meant we had to have another meeting. So we all got together. We got to thinking about it, you know. And I would dream about it. And all of a sudden, one night, it was, if an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? It was a group conscience. We all liked it, you know. And the thing about it is, what you think on long enough, you will act upon. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depends. If it's good stuff and you think about it, you act upon it. But when it's not good stuff, you know, you still will act upon that. At least I do. And so that was the kind of thinking. And so now here I'm going to take an autonomous action, aren't I? Yes, I am. You know. And so the bottom line was, you know, I tried attempted murder. You know, it's nothing that I'm proud about because I have been to the prisons and there are people there for doing a lot less than I've done. You know, and I don't know why that wasn't my thing. I don't know why I didn't get there and why other, but I feel like there's people there doing time for me. Doing time for me. To be autonomous, you have to know who and what you are. If you're going to really, and first of all, nice morning. We'll all adjourn to the bingo lounge. Like I said, before my higher power, I'm a child of God, and I'm God's kid. I'm more than just a wife or a mother or a sister or a friend or a neighbor, but I'm a child of God, and I need to learn what a child of God does and what a child of God doesn't, you know. And my actions are can be destructive when my character defects take over. You know, that's what ruins your actions is your character defects, you know. I've had these little autonomous actions all along. After we had that decision making about the truck and the sports car, I mean, when we made that one day I was driving that truck that nobody liked, and I went tearing down the road, and as I passed the dealership, this station wagon called to me from off the lot. Murphy, Murphy, over here, Murphy. And there was this giant red station wagon with the wood trim and everything on it, you know. And I went, oh. And I went tearing home, you know, and I told J.D. about this wonder. I'm not riding in a damn hearse. I am not riding in a bus. He said, I don't want a big old car. That's that. So I go to work. I come home the next day as I'm coming past. Murphy! Murphy! And so I tear into the lot. And I walk over to the car and I lay my hands on it. And the salesman comes out and he says, would you like to drive this car? I said, no, I want to buy this car. And he said, you don't need to drive it. No, it called to me. It's my car. I've just laid hands on it. Here's what I'm paying. If I can have it for the same payment I'm making, I will take this car with me right now. He said, what you paying? I told him. Now, this truck is almost paid for. We're going there. So now we have another 3 years. And I drive in with the very vehicle that he didn't want. It was an autonomous action. I loved it, though, I will have to say. But I kept it 21 years. It was a very good car. I love that station wagon. And a bunch of you have ridden in that car many times. But you know, that was so funny. When I finally bought the next car, and the car salesperson was a lady, and she wanted to buy my car because it was in such good shape. Except it was just old, 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 and you can't find parts for them hardly. But she, her husband took it to use at work. And one day someone came into there and says, who's driving the red station wagon? And he said, I am. And they said, I was raised in that car. Can I eat my lunch out there? And one of the kids who had gone through Alateen and then into Al-Anon was working there. I thought it was sort of funny. Another thing that can be destructive was me in the mall. I had this thing about buying stuff made me feel good. And buying stuff that I couldn't afford and could impress you with made me feel better. You know, I don't know why I was like that, but I just had to do that. It was like, you know, I came, I saw, I conquered. I was like MacArthur, you know, charge! You know, I mean, just, you know. J.D. used to tease me and say my charge cards were like OCB papers. To get them apart, I had to go and blow them. You know, they were so thin from use, you know. That's the thing you roll cigarettes with, OCB papers. Okay. Okay. I'm dating myself here. Yeah, yes, I see that, you know. Well, I'm old, for God's sake. Think about rolling marijuana. Zigzags. Zigzags. Okay. I'm not a dope smoker. I'm a dope collector. But I found that there was a way to cure myself of this. And that was taking things back. You know, it got to the point where I would buy stuff. I'd still go to the mall and buy stuff. And then when I'd get it home, and then I'd go, I don't know why I have this. You know, the next day, it's like it seemed like a good idea at the time. I saw it. I wanted it. I wanted it. I needed it. I got it. I brought it home. What the hell am I going to do with it? And so what I used to do was give it away so I didn't have to look at it. But you still have to pay for it when you do that. But you see, if you take something back, that means you're telling the story you made a mistake. You know. And so I would go and I would have to take these things back. And it got to a point there for a while, the salesperson, when they would sell it, they were working on commission, you know. And they knew me and they'd say, do you really want this? Because we don't want to have to reverse it out tomorrow, you know. It's a lot more hassle to have to take something back. But even to this day, it does not bother me to take things back when I've done that. I had a couch that I bought. Now, I had been looking for a particular kind of couch for a long time. And when I went to the most expensive store in Little Rock, they had the style of the couch I wanted. Not the fabric, but they showed me all these wonderful swatches. And I picked the fabric that was crushed velvet print from Belgium. And I did this on my lunch hour. And I had a girl that worked with me. And I ordered the couch to be made at the factory, special order. And we left the store and she said, how much is that going to cost? And I said, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. And I couldn't. Well, the couch was supposed to be there in 90 days. But long time ago, they had a longshoreman strike up in New York. And my fabric was on the boat. So I went 6 months without a couch. It was a real nice Christmas that year, sitting in the floor, having people over and that kind of thing. And when the couch finally got there, you know, here's an $1,800 couch. And we're talking 1976. Yes, it was a wonderful couch. That Clayton Marcus couch was a wonderful couch. And today it's sitting in the Wolf Street Center in Little Rock in the old timers room because I just couldn't part with it any other way. Because J.D., I had kept it all these years and it's been recovered because you can't wear it out. It's a good couch. But J.D. decided this last year that he wanted more togetherness. Now, we each had our chairs, and the couch was for company. And he said, you know, he said, I almost lost you. And he said, I want us to be closer. And he said, I want us to get the couch that has the recliners. And so we could put the dogs in the middle, and we could sit there together and hold hands and have our dogs there with us. And so we got the couch. The only problem was our dogs didn't make it. We lost both of our babies this year. But we have the couch. And the funny thing now is, I'm small enough I can sit in his lap in the chair. You know, things change, you know. You know, your mind works very, very fast. Beware of your mind. I was talking to a girl I sponsored. She said, just a minute, someone's at the door. She went to the door. Was back at the phone, I know, not more than 30, 40 seconds at the most. And here's what happened while she was gone. I'm hungry. Boy, wouldn't a bacon and tomato sandwich be good? But you can't have a bacon and tomato sandwich. Why? Well, you've cleaned your stove. And you know, bacon spatters. And once you clean the stove, you don't ever want to use it again. You know, it's so hard to get the damn spattered grease off the stove. What you need is a microwave. You're right. 45 seconds. I have bought, justified, and talked myself into a microwave oven. Didn't have one, you know. And so I told her, I said, thank God you're back. I just bought a microwave. She said, how? And I said, that was amazing. And she said, well, I said, how fast our mind works. I had never really thought about how fast our mind works. But when I was relating that to her, and when you realize what a short span, how you can go from this point to that point, that is amazing. How the mind will, you know, it's like when you're telling a story, it would take me forever to tell a story because I would think of other things along the way, and I would get out here and here and here, and then pretty soon I forgot why I'd even started the story. You know, because your mind just goes like that. So when J.D. got home from work that day, I told him about the microwave and how fast my mind worked. He said, you know, we probably could use one of those. Now, I know it's not a good idea. You know, we fight change. You know, it's something newfangled, you know. We fight change, you know, and love the microwave. You know, but that's the way my mind always works. That's just like at his job, he came in and he said, well, they're going to put everything on that where they automatically transfer the money to the bank. And you don't get a paycheck anymore. Don't like that. Want to see money on the paycheck? Don't like that. Now, aren't we glad they do that, you know? But it's those changes, you know, and I think probably I've noticed that the older I get, the harder it is to adapt to those changes. But life changes all the time. Life changes, and if you don't change with it, you're lost in the behind there, you know? We learn that we're not victims, we're volunteers. We make our choices, and then we're responsible for the choices we make. That's what autonomy is all about. You can make your choices. I've learned that ego-driven people rarely have a healthy relationship because they want things their way. That's the only way. You know, the right way is my way, don't you know? I used to say, you know, I'm a natural-born leader. And the reason was I didn't know how to follow. I either lead or I don't go. Because, you see, when you're leading, you're in control. And you don't have to worry about all the, you know, being someone else in control. That's like giving and receiving. Have you ever thought about it? Most of us like to give because you're in control when you're giving. You decide who to, when to, where to, whatever. But when other people, how can you receive? Isn't it hard to receive from other people, you know, because they're in control then. And you're at their mercy. You get whatever, you know. It's much harder. And I didn't realize that for a long, long time. I have also a handicap, or sometimes I think it's amazing, is that sometimes I hear things the same time you do when I say it. It bypasses my thought process. I don't know how that happens. You know, it's just like I hear it the same time you do. I wonder where that came from. You know, it's like one night we're playing Trivia Pursuit, and there was a question, and I just gave the answer, and I have no idea where that came from. I didn't know I knew that, you know. It was just one of those things, you know, hell, there it was. And that's like one day, I wish Jennifer was here. I'm going to talk to her about that. Jennifer and I were working in a public information booth at the mall. And when we did our little shift in there, and we went down and had lunch, well, that morning before we left, J.D. had said, honey, while you're out at the mall, see if you can find some sealer because we got a crack in one of the bird baths. Okay? Now, so I tell her, I said, we need to go down to Sears, which is not a good place for me to go, by the way. I have had lots of little tragedies at Sears. I'm not a good Sears shopper. But I went down there and to find it, and as I walked into the paint department, I figured that's where you'd find this kind of stuff, the salesman approached me. And here's what happened. I said, good afternoon. I'm a Sears personal shopper. I'm here to evaluate your knowledge of all of our products. If I were in here as a customer trying to buy a product to seal a bird bath or fountain, which one of our products would you recommend? And the little boy says, oh. And he gets his little book and he starts looking through it frantically, you know, and then he says, this is the one. And I said, that's correct, and I'll take a gallon. I said, may I have your employee number so that I may fill out my report? And Jennifer says, I didn't know you were a Sears personal shopper. And I said, I'm not. She said, what was that? I said, I don't know. I heard it the same time you did. And it's like when those happen, you have to go to the end to see what happens. You know what I mean? It's like you can't stop. You got to follow through with that. You know, I don't know how that happened. And she said, well, wasn't that a lie? Do you have to make an amends for that? And I said, I don't reckon I hurt him, Jennifer. And I said, yes, it was a lie, and I don't know why it happened. And I said, but I will write the store and tell them about the nice young man by name and number. And I got a reply from Sears that says, we rarely get a letter like this. And especially from me. You know, I had written them volumes of the other kind over there. Now, there's a difference between affecting someone adversely as opposed to them not liking what you're doing. You know, there's a difference there. You know, my sister, before all this happened, I told her, I said, you know, I think I'd like to go up to Eureka Springs and just spend the night and stop along the way and look at all those things that you don't get to see, because when you're riding with someone else, usually, you know, it's like sometimes I get in the car with someone and we've got to go from point A to point B and don't stop except to pee. You know, we got that. Where I like to see these little go off here, go off there, and you know, when you get there, you know. I said, I can do that, I can do that. And my sister says to me, you can't go up there by yourself. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, that's a long drive up there by yourself. Now, I travel all over the world by myself on an airplane, and my sister doesn't want me to drive 3 hours to Eureka Springs, you know. I mean, I'm like, what is the deal there? And I said, well, you want to go with me? No, I don't want to go with you. Well, I'm going to go. Well, she got really, really agitated about that. But, you know, that's her problem. I went and I had a great time. I went the day after Thanksgiving. I found out they have the most wonderful little trolley, and they do carols on the trolley, and everybody sings and drives all over town, looks at the Christmas lights. It was just fabulous. And it was something I would have missed if I had allowed somebody else's feelings or attitude stop me from doing that. Don't do things in order to get a reaction back from someone else. You know, so many times we're guilty of doing that little number, you know. You say, I love you, when in fact what you want to hear them say to you is, I love you too. You know, you're fishing, you know. Say it when you want to say it. Don't say it in order to get a response back. And how many times I have done this thinking he would do that. You know, those kind of things. We don't do that. J.D. took an autonomous action. He's taken several over the years that have not necessarily thrilled me. You know. And we've been dealing with one. About 20 years ago, J.D. decided to plant a muscadine vine by our pecan tree. I said at the time, do you think that's a good idea? I didn't. And he informed me that he was from the country and he knew all about stuff for growing and muscadines in particular. Well, we have a tree now. The pecan tree is being killed because of the vine is bigger than my arm. And it goes, and it's also gone over to the next door neighbor's tree in their backyard. And it's gone over here. And we had this big ice storm during the winter, during December. And we have big broken limbs that are hanging but can't get down, big limbs, because of this massive vine that has taken over that tree. And so we've been out there cutting, and we could not get a tree trimmer to come and get the tree because they can't get it because of the vine, and their saws don't cut. You got to do those little pruny things. Notice broken blister, little cutty poos. Those little tentacles on that muscadine are like wire. They're really vicious. My next door neighbor asked me the other day, he said, are you all right? I saw you on your butt several times in the yard. And I said, fine, you should ask now, you know. And yes, because you're pulling and tugging, and when it lets go, you go back with it. I mean, and we've taken some terrible falls. We've got bruises and cuts and everything everywhere. But we're trying to do it. But see, that's one of those things. Well, J.D. had talked to me and mentioned for about a year, and he got all these little books on water gardens. He says, we need a water garden. Now, if you've ever been to our house, you know we have a yard that is rooms. You have the southwest area with the cactus and the stuff, and then you've got the meditation area with the little trees and the little fountains and stuff. And you've got the gazebo, and you've got the turtle refuge. Well, now we got to have a water garden. And I'm going, where are we going to put the water garden? He said, well, he was going to give up the grape arbor and over there. And so he told me it was going to be about like 3 by 6 foot, just a little small thing for the birds, you know, have a little trickle water thing. Well, I go off to Kentucky for the weekend to talk at a conference, and I come back, and I have a swimming pool in my backyard. Little Digger Odell has been out there digging like a maniac while I was gone. Now, J.D. has a lot of wonderful ideas, but J.D., see, when I think about doing stuff, I think about, well, okay, you do this, and then you have to do this, and you have to do... I follow the process. J.D. does it. And then he... Oh, now, what do you do with this? And so, digging a hole that is 12 by 18, and that's 5 foot deep, what do you do with the dirt? That's a lot of dirt. I will spread it over the entire of the backyard, and when it rains, it'll go away. Unfortunately, it didn't work that way. It rained all right. It rained on Sunday. Now, we had the two poodles. They have their own pet door. J.D. goes to work. Does he mention there's a hole in the backyard? No. He doesn't say a word about the surprise out in the backyard like I'm not going to notice. And I wake up, and I call my sponsor. I talked to her that morning, and I hung up the phone. What's all over these? What in the world is all over the bed? My God, it looks like... mud? Where would my dogs get into mud? Oh, my God, my dogs. These are mud balls. I mean, my poodles look like they're brown and they're black, you know. And I'm going, I don't believe this. And so I begin to look, and all over the carpet is all this mud. And on the couches, it's like the dogs decided to do the whole house in mud. And it's like, my God, what is it? And I go out in the back, and then I go, oh, my God, the whole backyard is a river of mud. And then there's this giant hole out there, you know. I'll kill him this time for sure. Can you imagine anybody who has been drowned to build a water garden in their backyard 5 foot deep? This man is demented. You know, I mean, why would you put another water hazard out there, you know? And if he drowns, they'll always know I did it. You know what I mean? Oh. So I called my sponsor, and I told her what had happened, and she said, how long before he comes home? And I said, about 5 hours. And she said, well, it may be long enough to save his life. She said, you pray. Well, the first thing to do, you've got to lock the pet door. You got to bathe the dogs so that they quit going out. You know, dogs love to roll and stuff. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. You get a dead something out there. Man, they love dead. Dead is first choice, you know. Blah. Well, I get the dogs bathed. Well, now the dogs have had their own pet door all their life. How do I know when they go? So now I've got leashes on my dogs, and I'm walking them every hour because I don't know if they need to go because I never pay any attention to when they go, how they go, where they go. You know, very sweet little dogs. And I'm out there, and so J.D. comes home, and I'm out in the front walking the dogs. He said, what's the matter with you? What are you doing? And I said, go in the house, take a look, and when I come back, have a solution. We were having house guests in 2 days. Now here this is, it's February. For Christmas, I had had my carpets and my furniture professionally cleaned. I was not a happy camper. The autonomous action did more than make me angry. And I think one of the worst parts of the autonomous action was I had been left out of the decision loop. It's like I went out of town. Here's how I perceived it. I went out of town. He had decided to make it bigger, didn't want to tell me because he didn't want me to say, I don't want one that big, so I'll just do it, and once I've got it done, she can't say anything. There's it. You know, there were my feelings, you know. And not only that, but now who had the fallout to deal with? It's sort of like alcoholism, you know. They go out, get drunk, maybe get thrown, but you've got to deal with fallout. There's fallout to deal with, and man, did I have a resentment. And so I wasn't going to like anything about the water garden. I can tell you, when something like that happens, no matter how pretty, no matter how with this, you're not going to like it if you're like me, because that was the resentment garden. And so when he looked, he said, we're going to have to cross fence the yard and keep the dogs on the patio instead of letting them out. So that we have an outside patio that we could hose off as well as the inside, but it made me very angry. Now, this was February. In May, we have a yard party at our house. In May, we still had mud. Still had it. And the dogs were still. And now the water garden had taken place out there, and he had got this big sheets of marble and beat them up with a sledgehammer. Wanted this mosaic look around the pond. Now we have what really looks like the deck on the swimming pool. Does not resemble any water garden in any book we've ever looked at. And I am still just, he'll say, well, what part do you not like them? I hate the whole damn thing. And besides that, it's dangerous. And he said, what do you mean? I said, the dogs play soccer. The dogs would run across the yard with the soccer ball. They would fall in the pool. My dogs would drown. He said, they can swim. I said, not for forever. So how do you get out of real deep water when there's no way to get out? I said, they're not going to swim and then go out of the pool. I said, they can't do that. And he says, I'm being a fanatic and I just don't like it. And so we fought about this. And I'm telling you, this made a serious tear in our relationship, because we could not fight that hard out there and not bring it back in the house. It was very, very difficult. And so I prayed about it. I prayed about it. First, I had to be willing to let go of the resentment. That took a long time. And so later that summer, and we were talking to each other, but not, you know how you snap at each other? And we were having what we call hall sex. You know, that's where you pass in the hall and go, you know, I mean. Wasn't real nice at our house. And it's amazing, you know, because, I mean, we've been in the program at that point, what, almost 20 years? You know, you'd think you could, but we were really having a hard time with this. And so anyway, prayed about it, and God's solution. God changed the cable. Now, is that strange? All of a sudden, we started getting the Home and Garden Channel. And on the Home and Garden Channel, they had a thing about water gardens. I don't know why I sit there and watch that. But I was just sitting there one night, and I saw that, and they were talking about the gardener has a dream, and that sometimes it takes many years for a water garden to get the way you envision it to get. It's very hard to take anything brand new like that for it looks like it's been there forever type thing. And they went through a lot of different kind of plans and gyrations about it. But I realized that one more time, I was ruining his dream with my negative attitude, and that I needed to find something good about the water garden, because it was there, accept it, live with it, and move on, you know. And so when he came home, I told him I wanted to talk to him about the water garden. And so, I mean, he goes, oh, God, not that again. I said, no, I want to tell you what I saw today. And I was telling him, and I said, I need to make an amends, and what can I do to help you? And he said, the water garden didn't turn out like I thought it was going to. And he said, I really don't like it the way it is, but I don't know what to do with it now. And I said, well, first of all, I would say get rid of that damn marble and make it safe. I said, most of them are got rocks and stuff around them, which would be more of a barrier for something rather than the dogs just falling in the pool. He said, well, what kind of rocks? And I said, now, over the years, I had collected big rocks wherever I went. I've got big rocks from California. I've got one from Big Sur. I've got them from Sedona, Arizona. I've got lots of rocks from all over the country. I even have some rocks from Africa. And I said, I'll give you my rocks to build your garden, and I'll help you. And he said, you'd even help me? I said, yeah, I'll help you. And so we were, and there was just enough rocks and everything to make the water garden, to give it where it would be safe, you know. So we worked it, and he kept saying, though, I think you're being a fanatic. And like I say, he rescues box turtles, and we have a turtle refuge. And one afternoon, he came home, and two of his turtles had gotten into. Now, box turtles are not water turtles. They swim, but not for forever. you know, and so they had drowned in the pool. So he saw what I meant, that it wasn't safe. You know, that was another incentive to change it. But we took all those rocks and we built the water garden. And I said, you know, I can even build a waterfall. I saw how to do that on the Home and Garden TV. So we built three waterfalls. The first looked absolutely gorgeous. Wouldn't work, but it looked good. The second one, when we got down to the last rock, J.D. was tired, and he gave it a shove, and it all went, because it hadn't settled, and it all went in the bottom of the pond. We had to start over again. And everything, we have had the big water lilies and the lotus and all like that, and it has been very, very pretty. J.D.'s made a bunch of metal sculptures and stuff out there. Just absolutely very pretty. And back during the ice storm, the water garden bit the dust, literally. The big limb fell in, knocked a hole in the liner. So our water garden is now a work in progress again. So we're changing it. But you know the difference? We're doing it together. See, there's the thing. You know, instead of everybody doing their own thing, we've decided in the last year or two, we have really found that we enjoy working together, which was something we never did before because we couldn't work together. We had to be boss, foreman, and worker. And now we're both workers. And we both sit down and we plan what we're going to do and we talk about it. And we haven't had those kind of problems, you know. So this deal can work. The autonomous action is measured by its negative effect. If your autonomous action leaves a lasting negative effect on the relationship, then that shouldn't have been an action you should have taken, you know. Those kind of things. That's how you do that. Okay, we'll get 5 through 8. I can't even count. 5, 6, 7, and 8 this afternoon, if you can still stand it. Okay?